Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Julia Zweig, award-winning author of books on Cuba, Latin America, and American foreign policy. She's a senior research fellow at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. And we're talking about her latest book, Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight. Julia, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk about this monumental history.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here with you, Mark. Thank you.
How were you drawn to the story? Actually, that's sort of a straight lining you because it's an obviously great story. But why you and why this story?
Well, no, it's a good question because I am a foreign policy diplomatic historian, policy wonk by practice and by training and for most of my professional career. But in working in a world that is quite imbalanced in the gender department, in the world of foreign policy, I just got to a point where I wanted to kind of pull back and think more deeply and broadly about women and power.
Yeah.
And had kind of maxed out the other work that I was doing and needed to learn something new. And when I discovered that Lady Bird Johnson, who's a person associated with the president, maybe most associated with the word power in the 20th century, Lyndon Johnson, and that she kept this incredible trove of audio tapes, her own LBJ tapes, if you will, that just hooked me because the story inside of that story we think we knew just revealed itself day after day as I read through her material to be very different than what we had assumed was the case, we generally, in terms of the conventional wisdom about Johnson.
These tapes, there were 850 of them. They were basically daily diary entries?
Yes. I mean, not entirely daily, but her first entry was recorded 8 days after the JFK assassination. So she would often tape a few days since when she was recording. So November 22nd is the assassination. Her first recording records her experience in Dallas, and it's totally riveting. And it goes all the way through the end of January of 1969, and it's 123 hours. And she recorded 850 different days of her experience. Yeah, really unbelievable.
In many ways, in summation, and you write this in your book, she redefined the role of the First Lady. She was a very savvy politician and an active politician. And I don't think until this book, she really has gotten credit for it.
You know, I agree she hasn't gotten credit until this book. And I think that that's for a few reasons. Her political acumen and her savvy and the fact that she liked politics so much.
Yeah.
Not initially, but by the time Lyndon Johnson is Senate Majority Leader, and certainly by the time they're in the 1960 campaign and then in the White House years, she is just a total pro. And she is part of this partnership that forms the Johnson presidency, upside and downside, no question about it. And in terms of what she did with the First Lady role, I think she's really the first lady since Eleanor Roosevelt who knits together East Wing, West Wing political operation,
right,
and tries to make the East Wing really a component of the overall White House policy and political agenda.
From the get-go, your book is just fascinating. There's a detailed section, and this is something I don't even imagine. After the Kennedy assassination, of her transitioning into the White House, and how emotionally awkward and strange that was. How did she relate to Jackie?
Yeah, I wasn't initially going to dive as deeply as I did into the Lady Bird Jackie relationship. And
yeah.
I can credit one of my best friends for saying, you know, you got to do that.
And
she was so right about it because the more I looked at it, the more what I saw in those 14 days from November 22nd, 1963 to December 6th, 1963, when the Jackie and the kids move out and the Johnsons move into the White House, is this kind of excruciatingly careful and sensitive and difficult transition that the two women orchestrate. And it's so freighted with history and emotion and Lady Bird's consciousness of this incredible, difficult role she has to step into under these horrible circumstances. Jackie has, of course, lost her husband and is somebody who is so different from Lady Bird from Jackie, but they have a long history already, almost 10 years of, actually 10 years, because Jackie comes to Washington in 1953, and by 55, Lady Bird's the wife of the Senate Majority Leader, and she kind of brings Jackie into the fold of the scene of Senate spouses, and then works very, very hard in the 60 campaign, then as second lady, and so by the time the assassination happens, there's a lot of trust and intimacy between those two. And I think you see it in the way they managed the transition together.
Now, she was always concerned about Lyndon's health and his depression. And I don't think the people in America knew the challenges of Lyndon's health. Can you talk about that? And her role, I mean, her first concern always was Lyndon and his health.
Well, and for good reason, and for two fundamental reasons. One, which maybe people know more about, is that in 1950, I mean, people that follow Lyndon Johnson history, but he had a kind of chronic heart issues, and he had a major heart attack in 1955 that almost killed him, and that's when he stopped smoking. His father and his uncles both died of heart disease at 60 years old. So when he comes into the White House, he's 56, and Lyndon and Lady Bird are, you know, freaked out that this is a job that could kill him or debilitate him severely the way Woodrow Wilson was so severely debilitated in office. So one thing was his overall health and his cardiac health. But the second thing has to do with his depression, which was chronic and untreated as depression is treated today. And it really got in the way of his ability to perform his duties. And she was the person who, time and again, helped him manage to crawl out of what she called the Valley of the Black Pig from Yeats, or the Black Beast of Depression. And that stayed with him until the end of his life.
I mean, he didn't want to run for president. And it was really, he turned to her for some kind of plan, some kind of idea of how to move forward. And she was there for him to help him make those decisions.
Well, yes, and I think that's actually one of the most surprising parts of my research. And that has to do with the number of times we know about some of the moments in the presidential history, especially right before the August 1964 convention in Atlantic City when he had this big wave of doubt. But there are two other moments that I write about in the book, one in May of 1964 and one in October of 65, and I have to assume there were more. But the two additional moments that I found really show him to have this level of self-doubt and insecurity about his ability to keep the country united, to have the stamina to deal with with Vietnam, to have, so let me go back. In May of 64, big moment when Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense, comes back from Vietnam on his fifth trip since JFK died, and he is pushing along with the rest of the Kennedy War Council that LBJ has kept on board for escalating in Vietnam. LBJ and Lady Bird know that this is going to have the potential of derailing their domestic agenda for the country. And this is when he's introduced civil rights legislation, he's introduced war on poverty legislation, but both are moving their way, and especially civil rights is stuck in Congress. So he's looking at the November 64 election, and he says to Lady Bird, I'm not sure that if I do win, I want to do this, that I can do it, that the country will stay behind me, and asks her to write out an analysis and a pro and con strategy memo for him. She does it, and she makes this recommendation that it's too early for him to get out, that he should not use his health as an excuse to get out, that if they go back to the ranch now, he'll drive her crazy and himself, that he's got way too many ambitions still, and that he should run. But then, importantly, Mark, she says, in February or March of 1968, you can announce to the country that you won't be standing for a second term. And of course, that is precisely what he does on March 31, 1968.
I can remember it.
You can remember it. Well, I can't. But in any case,
I can tell you right then, the people were shocked. People were shocked.
Exactly. That's the point. Only a handful of people, two or three people, knew that he was about to do that. And at the time, the analysis was, oh, well, this is Bobby Kennedy, and this is Gene McCarthy, and this is Vietnam, and riots, and of course this is a devastated presidency. Of course he's not going to run. But now, I mean, you could do the counterfactual and say, well, you know, if everything had gone really well, he wouldn't have stepped away from power, and possibly that's true. But it's kind of a pointless exercise given what actually happened.
Part of she's involved in this whole sort of weird dichotomy of the Lyndon Johnson administration. On one hand, you have really important social policies being sort of proposed and hopefully passed, the war on poverty, civil rights agendas, the Civil Rights Act, and so on and so forth. And then on the other hand, you have the morass of Vietnam, which he's going to be forever associated with. Mm-hmm. And she decides to do sort of an interesting thing. She gets involved in the environment and conservation. Now, a lot of people just remember it as Beautify America. Nothing could be further from the truth. She was interested in urban redesign.
Yeah, I know. That really blew my mind when I discovered that. And the Beautify America component, you know, that was a term that was designed at broadening the public consciousness about environmentalism. She said as much later on, and that's what was going on there. But she hated the term because it diminished the substance of her agenda, and it diminished her. What she was really trying to do in that context of civil rights and great society was to bring together the idea of access to nature in American cities with civil rights, especially access to nature in American cities for the most deprived, for the communities of color who had lost their homes to urban renewal projects all over the country, or to big highway development that was, you know, cutting out swaths of cities where mostly people of color live to put in huge infrastructure and highway projects. So she was trying to make the American city a place where those living in them with least access to resources had access to nature nevertheless.
One of her big people that she worked with or that she admired was Lawrence Halprin.
Yes.
Can you talk about who he was?
Sure. This was another really interesting discovery for me. Lawrence Halprin is a landscape architect. He died in the last 5 or 6 years. People might know, your listeners might know him, Mark, because he is the architect that designed the FDR Monument in Washington, D.C. And that was a multi-decade project from soup to nuts. And the final people in the White House that inaugurated that were the Clintons. But Lawrence Halprin's first important relationship in the White House wasn't with Hillary and Bill Clinton. It was with Lady Bird Johnson. At the time, he was a hippie architect in Marin County who was married to this avant-garde choreographer. And they had, you know, kind of all of the 60s counterculture elements of their lives together and separately. And he was a very important influence on Lady Bird. He was somebody who did a lot of thinking about this very idea of making cities livable, not just for those that can afford it, but for the most underserved. He was also a private landscape architect who did projects for the wealthy all over California and actually the country. But with Lady Bird, what he was recruited to do with support from the philanthropist Stephen Currier and also Lawrence Rockefeller was to come up with a master plan, that was the term for Washington, D.C.,
right,
which would, especially focusing on the riverfront and waterfront green space along the Anacostia River, which is abuts the parts of Washington where Black Washingtonians live, as opposed to the Potomac, which tends to be where white Washingtonians live, to figure out a way to develop that and to desegregate it and to build massive public recreation spaces with federal dollars for D.C. citizens who had no representation in Congress, well, still barely do, and no statehood, obviously, and were controlled, their budget was controlled by a white supremacist in the House of Representatives. So by Lady Bird recruiting Halperin with the support of these environmental and civil rights philanthropists, what she was doing was really incredibly ambitious.
Yeah.
Incredibly ambitious and poking her eye right in the notion that Washington, D.C. somehow had to remain sort of subordinate and segregated as so much as it was at the time compared to now.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Julia Zweig, award-winning author of books on Cuba, Latin America, and American foreign policy. She's a senior research fellow at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. We're talking about her really fascinating book, Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight. I want to talk about her on the stump for Johnson, for LBJ, for Lyndon. She, as you write, this is a quote from your book, she could stump before factory workers in the Midwest. She knew how to reach housewives in the West. She could quote Whitman, Eliot, and Thoreau. She was a force to be dealt with on the stump.
Yes, she was. You know, in the 1964 campaign, after the convention, before and after the 64 convention in Atlantic City, she went out and campaigned all over the country. And Lyndon's guys who were traveling with her came back and wrote to LBJ, whoa, you know, your wife is a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah.
She's the surrogate everybody wants. There were other members of Congress who said, whoa, you know, run her for Congress. And by 64, once he's elected, but even before that, people start referring to her as Mrs. Vice President, kind of jokingly. But, you know, we forget that LBJ didn't have a vice president until he was elected with Humphrey on the ticket. But for that entire period of time, she was the person that was his major surrogate on the stump and otherwise. And of course, we really see this when she, after the right before the election in September of 64, after the first Civil Rights Act has passed, when Lyndon famously tells Bill Moyers that we've lost, the Democratic Party has lost the South, basically for the foreseeable future. She, who is raised partially in Alabama, very much a Southerner, deep understanding of white supremacy, says, yeah, but no, I don't want to lose this by default. And so she and a team of phenomenally powerful women organized a 47-stop, 4-day, 8-state whistle-stop tour through the Deep South.
And that's when you see her
just shine.
And the dark side of that was that hate stuff was all over the place because of her husband's civil rights legislation. You write that somebody burned a cross on the governor's lawn, Terry Sanford in North Carolina, where she was staying. There were placards stating Black Bird, go home. So she was still on the stump despite huge blowback because of the civil rights legislation.
Even death threats. I mean, by the time her train was getting ready to cross from Alabama to Florida, which is, you know, one of the most dangerous parts of the Deep South, there were death threats against her, and the Secret Service had to send out a dummy train and helicopters and bomb-sniffing dogs, and she was sort of cool as a cucumber about it. But that shows you just what a backlash she and LBJ were facing around civil rights and just how serious she was about pushing forward and her belief that the South would eventually come on board, which it has and hasn't. So
there's a story. It's just one of many in your book about the conflict between, again, the morass in Vietnam and what the social agenda of the Johnsons. Mm-hmm. She tried to hold a White House arts festival. That just turned into a disaster. Can you talk about that? I mean, that's an amazing story.
You know, and it's early on in their presidency. It happened in the summer of 1965. And you have to people really forget that public opinion kind of still was very much firmly and positively in the Johnson camp still in 1965, even around Vietnam. They, by and large, had support for staying in Vietnam. This is before the draft and before, you know, massive troop mobilization. But in any case, in 65, and this kind of goes back a little bit to Jackie, right? She gets the opportunity to put together this one-day massive White House Arts Festival and does it and hosts. I mean, you know, it was a day where if this happened today, it would just be jaw-dropping, the list of contemporary American artists. There were hundreds of them, you know, Mark Rothko and Richard Diebenkorn and, you know, the Dance Theater of Harlem and numerous photographers that Americans at the time had never heard of. It was a very, very major kind of Texan scale embrace of contemporary modern art and the arts generally. But the there was a poet by the name of Robert Lowell who was invited to come and speak and then publicly recanted the invitation. That was followed by a number of other individuals organized by the New York Review of Books editor Bob Silvers, basically writing to the president and publicizing what they had written in the New York Times, saying that we cannot stomach what you're doing in Vietnam. We might support you domestically, but no. And that was before the day of the festival. So a day that could otherwise have been really to showcase these, you know, the Johnsons were sensitive about their reputation as these kind of Southern hicks. And here they were coming in on the heels of the Kennedys, these elite cultural snobs, and they had the opportunity to show themselves to be arts people as well. In fact, they were. The Johnson White House put more money into public arts funding than any president before or since. But the Vietnam story totally overshadowed it, and it really left a bad taste in Lady Bird's mouth about just how significant that war was going to be in terms of navigating, supporting her husband, but having a diversified domestic agenda at the same time.
It is amazing when you look back at what he accomplished on the social agenda side, the Voting Rights Act, Medicare bill, programs like Head Start, all of that, the Immigration and Nationality Act, all of that started with and was passed by during LBJ's time. He had a famous gallstone surgery too. It was planned surgery, and I can remember the pictures of him showing off his scar. That was plastered all over the papers. Was she nervous when he went in for surgery?
Well, that surgery, which was October of 1965, so still sort of early days, she was nervous because, you know, gallstone surgery today is an outpatient procedure, but at the time it's general anesthesia and a 2-week
right.
hospitalization for recovery. So she was extremely nervous about it. So was he. They were ready for also, I shouldn't say that. They were not ready, but then we talked earlier about his depression. You remember that picture of him kind of obnoxiously showing his huge scar,
yeah.
which is then memorialized by that cartoonist David Levine in the New York Review of Books, who makes it the shape of Vietnam. In the cartoon that he drew. But a couple of days after that moment, and also he signed 13 policy bills when he was at the hospital, but he sank shortly thereafter into a huge depression.
Right.
And one of the things that the Lady Bird diary tapes show that has never been, that I know of, reported on before, was that he dictated a resignation statement. He was so depressed and so overwhelmed by his job and so sad about Vietnam and so unable to figure out a way out that he had an associate Supreme Court Justice, Abe Fortas, one of his old and close allies, come to the hospital, and he and Lady Bird sat with LBJ as he dictated his resignation statement. And then there, of course, was Lady Bird to talk him out of it and pull him back from the brink.
We just have a few minutes left. What was her life like after he passed?
You know, the two of them never had anything that would approximate work-life balance while he was alive. And when they went back to the ranch after 1969, January 69, he lived until 1973. In fact, he died on the day that the Roe v. Wade finding of the Supreme Court was issued. he died right before Nixon was getting ready to announce a peace agreement with the North Vietnamese, just for context. Lady Bird calmed down considerably, and she spent a lot of time, traveling around the world with her kids and grandkids. She brought to Austin with her support for green space in Austin and the creation of what's now called Lady Bird Lake. It was Town Lake before she died. The idea of public access to green space in American cities. She campaigned for it, raised a ton of money for it, made it part of Austin's permanent infrastructure now. She sat on the board of the UT, University of Texas Regents. She put a lot of energy into building the LBJ Library and LBJ School of Public Affairs as institutions. She was involved in running the family business for some time. So she
had no desire to get into politics on her own.
Not that I know of. No, I think she was, you know, once they set the date for leaving in March of 68, you can see in her diaries, she's counting the days.
I know, she's out of there. She's out of there.
Yeah, she's so ready to get out and be done.
In 2013, Lady Bird Johnson was posthumously awarded the Rachel Carson, Carson Award by National Audubon for her work with the environment. And I think that's going to be her permanent legacy, don't you think?
Well, I think so, but I still feel that not enough people sort of, how do you make material what that legacy is?
Yeah.
I think right now we're starting to see it in our discussions about how do we spend this infrastructure money and how does it impact different communities? The public consciousness raising that she was responsible for, when consciousness is kind of an ephemeral thing. But I do think it is her most important legacy, as is the LBJ presidency itself.
That's right.
Which she often called our presidency, Mark.
My guest tonight has been Julia Zweig, award-winning author of books on Cuba, Latin America, and American foreign policy. She is a senior research fellow at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. And we've been talking about a monumental, this is a perfect book to read this summer, Lady Bird Johnson, Hiding in Plain Sight. Julia, it's been a real pleasure.
So much fun to be talking with you tonight, Mark. Thank you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.